Hi, everybody. My name is Paul Kimball. Welcome to the View 902 podcast and my guest this evening. And it is this evening for me, even though it is, as I understand it, still this afternoon for him out in British Columbia. The one and only educator, author, journalist, environmentalist, and holder of both the Order of Canada and the Order of Nova Scotia, Silver Donald Cameron, a fellow I've always wanted to chat with, and now I have the opportunity. Welcome, Don, to the View 902 podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Even though you're there.
Even though I'm there.
I like to tell folks when I do these podcasts, I call them my Bill Clinton pivots. I have two pivots. A Bill Clinton pivot, which is very smooth, and I have a George W. Bush pivot, which is just kind of like invading Iraq. You just crash right into it without any sort of attention. So this is sort of like a Bill Clinton pivot, I guess, which is, as we're talking about how interconnected we all are now and how we can talk to folks anywhere in the world using Skype or cell phones or FaceTime, your book sort of struck me when I read it. And for folks who don't know, the book is From Manila to Manhattan, Attorneys for the Earth, Warrior Lawyers. To me, it's a fascinating book, but in an era of increasing globalization, breaking down the barriers to communication, which is a good thing, but also maybe breaking down some other barriers which serve to protect us in many cases, your book struck me as very timely because of all the things that that kind of globalization, that kind of impact is really sort of focusing in on. The environment seems to be one of those things where it's really having an impact, sometimes for good and sometimes not for good.
Well, and you know, the environment is something, I mean, the environment itself has become for me a bit of a tricky term because that suggests there's something out there that's different from us. And there isn't. I mean, the environment is, we are part of that and it's part of us and there is no real separation. But if you look at it just in terms of the sort of the human separation, it doesn't matter what country you're in. If the smudge is in the air and you're going to breathe it, it's going to have the same health effect on you, whether it came from North Korea and you're in, you know, Northern Alberta, or whether it came from Manila and you're in Melbourne. Doesn't make any much difference. This is a way in which we are all citizens of the same world. We all breathe the same air. We all drink the same water. We all have the same needs to live and to survive. And one of the things that was striking to me, I should just mention for those who aren't familiar with the book, that the book consists of 15 interviews with environmental lawyers who are making really interesting, innovative, and powerful uses of the law to serve environmental purposes. These are lawyers from all over the world. And one of the things that was really striking to me and to my producer-director colleague, Chris Beckett, as we went around interviewing these people, was that when you met them, it was like you'd always known them. It was like they were members of your tribe, even though they were from a nationality halfway on the other side of the world and you'd never laid eyes on them before. Right away, you had all this stuff in common. And we came to feel that this was what we were really seeing was the development of a global citizenship to match the globalization of the economy. And it's a very exciting thing and a very touching thing when you sit down with, well, Polly Higgins, for example, that I met for the first time in Amsterdam, British lawyer, who's trying to get ecocide made into one of the great international crimes, walked into the door. She walked into the door. We corresponded and read each other's work and so on and so forth, and instantly hugged. And I thought, now, how likely is that? Two people from opposite sides of the world will instantly fall into one another's arms. But it's a mark of mutual respect and mutual understanding, a real sense that you are the same people of the same tribe.
Yeah, it's interesting. Vera Rubin, who was a scientist, I mean, Carrie Fisher just died yesterday, so everyone knows that Princess Leia died. But, you know, also a couple of days ago, Vera Rubin died, the scientist who discovered dark matter. Not as reported on, certainly not in the mainstream media, not in pop culture, but one of the things that she was most famous for saying was, and a quote that really struck me is, you know, we're all kind of the same because we're all made up of star stuff. And I think she might have used a slightly more elegant term for that. But she was extending what you were talking about. And I absolutely take your point about the use of the term environment. She would extend the environment to mean the universe, the multiverse, you know, whatever verses are out there. Thinking of ourselves as something more than just ourselves, but as part of a greater whole, a greater community, a greater ecosystem, even. That is not, though, a traditional, okay, let me rephrase, because it is traditional, that is not the modern way in the Western world, generally speaking, of thinking of ourselves. And Donald Trump is president-elect of the United States of America. What do you think the future holds? I'll start by asking, what do you think the future holds? And then we can track backwards to maybe how some of the things that have happened in the past can inform maybe what we can do about this. But when you look at the future now and you see a President Trump and you see a President Putin and you see some of these countries out there, that don't pay particular attention at all to the environment. I don't know. Does it make you sad? Does it make you angry? And perhaps having done this book on warrior lawyers, maybe you can talk a bit about how folks might be able to look to the law as not just a shield, but actually a sword to further the cause of what I would call environmental justice, which might not be a term that you would accept, but that's the one I can think of off the top of my head.
Oh, no, I think that is the term, and I love the idea of it being a sword and not just a shield. And interestingly enough, Tony Aposa, the Philippine lawyer who's become one of my great heroes, talks about the sword of reason and talks about using the law in precisely these sort of chivalric terms. One of the things that also struck me very strongly in the course of the research for this book, and we really did travel pretty broadly for it, and met people from even further afield. I mean, we didn't go to the Philippines, but we met Tony in New York, having followed his work in the Philippines at long distance. One of the things that really struck me was that North Americans do live in a kind of a bubble, and it's a bubble in which we've had so much power over over the world around us that we tend to think very arrogantly about that, and we tend to forget that there is another whole. I mean, that most of the planet is not in North America. So, you know, Trump can say or feel or believe whatever he wants. It isn't going to keep the oceans from rising. It isn't going to keep the temperature from rising. And it isn't going to keep people in other countries from taking action about it. I mean, the fact that he happens to have divorced himself from reason, and that's really what it is. I mean, if you have a situation where, as you do, something like 97% of the qualified climate scientists say, yes, this is a serious problem, yes, it's largely anthropogenic, and yes, that the consequences are going to be catastrophic if we don't take action. It doesn't matter what Donald Trump thinks. That's the case. I mean, those are the findings from science. Those are the findings from people who study this. That's what the data tells us. And the fact that you don't choose to believe it, and it just means you won't be very well prepared for it. And, you know, like to me, it's really stunning that we don't connect the dots, or people like Trump don't connect the dots between, say, Hurricane Sandy and Hurricane Katrina, and which is precisely what the scientists are predicting. And now you see it, and they still say, oh, well, it's just, you know, it's a Chinese plot or something. I mean, we've literally taken leave of reason when we talk that way.
A lot of it comes back, and one of the things that advocates or proponents of environmental justice, of talking about these issues, would have to confront, that do have to confront, especially in North America or, you know, Europe on an almost daily basis, would be the economic argument. And I have a number of friends who, on one hand, will say, yes, climate change bad. And on the other hand, they'll say, well, you know, hydraulic fracking creates jobs, and we have a decaying healthcare system, and we need to find jobs so that we can employ people so they can pay taxes so they can support the healthcare system. You see them try and reconcile these two things in their mind. And I'm not going to say 9 times out of 10, but 7, 6, 6 or 7 times out of 10, they'll come down on the side of hydraulic fracking. And I'm just picking on hydraulic fracking I could pick a whole bunch of things. But it's the economic argument that they make, and they say, we recycle, we have a green bin, we'd love to do more, but we need jobs. What's the best argument to counter that after talking to all these various, in particular, lawyers who've used the legal system in their own way to counter these kinds of things? What do you see as the best argument to sort of counter that kind of mindset that we really seem to have over here?
Well, to some extent, the discussions are taking place on parallel tracks, and one of the things that allows people to think in that way is the very bad way in which we measure progress and costs and similar sorts of things. I mean, there was a UN report not very long ago that said something to the effect, and I don't have the numbers correctly, but something to the effect that 90% of the profitable corporations of the world would not be profitable if their true costs were included in the calculation. So, for example, you can be profitable as long as you're able to dump sewage into the river and pollutants and carbon and so forth into the air. If you actually had to pay for that, and you should, right? I mean, that is a genuine cost that's being borne by the environment at large, but also by you and me and the stuff that we breathe. So we're paying that cost. The company doesn't have to count it. But if it did have to count it, you would have to go back to that whole process and say, okay, does it make any sense to be doing this? Are we, in other words, is it really making prosperity, or is it making cost? That would be one question that's a bit abstruse for most people, but it actually happens to be accurate. The other one, I think, is that the countries which do the most for the environment are also the countries that are the most prosperous. And I'm thinking particularly about the Northern European countries, Scandinavia, Germany, and so on, which have done extremely well economically by taking this very, very seriously. And I don't know why it is that sometimes I think the Scandinavians were at the head of the line when the brains were handed out. But some of it is just paying attention. Like in 1973, when the first oil crisis struck, the Danes were really up against it because they've got no oil of their own and they've got practically no other energy sources of their own. They don't have any hydroelectricity. The country is flat. There's no falling water. And so they looked around and they said, well, what we do have is wind and what we do have is tide. But the first thing we need to do is stop. We're in a hole. We've got to stop digging. So the first thing they did was to say, nobody drives a vehicle on Sunday except for emergency vehicles. So right away, this 1/7 of their petroleum consumption vanished. That happened in North America, too. We were all conscious of the fact that oil was expensive and rare and so on, scarce and so on. But the moment it was over, we went back to sleep. The Danes didn't go back to sleep. The Danes said, okay, we don't want to ever be in that position again. The way out of this is clearly renewable energy. We have the technology to do that. We can invent what we don't have. We have the manufacturing capability and so forth. So now all those great big wind turbines that you see all around the world, you know, a very large proportion of those are made in Denmark. And guess how many jobs there are in that? It depends on how you look at things, and it depends on how you measure. And we did this big project, there's a film with it as well called Green Rights, about the uses of the law for environmental purposes. And it's taken us 4 or 5 years. If we were going to do another one, I said to Chris, you know, what would be another theme that we would tackle in this way? And he said, without hesitation, how we measure progress. Because we mislead ourselves all the time from a failure to measure things correctly.
In the book, you sort of talk about how the human right to a healthy environment is the newest of the human rights. And you talk, as you say, about the 90% of the countries in the world that have recognized that. And one of them is the Philippines, which in their constitution in 1987 did recognize those rights. And that leads to what to me is the most interesting of all these stories, because any lawyer will tell you, you don't like to lose. Clients don't like to lose. And yet this story of what happened in the Philippines, the case of Miners Aposa versus Factorin, right? Where it turns out that the guy who lost the case actually, as you write in your introduction, was delighted to lose. Perhaps you could sort of explain to the listeners, and this is one of the things that really struck me, like this wonderful story of how it all worked out and why the guy who was being sued was actually happy to lose. What was that case about and why is it important?
It's a wonderful story, and at the heart of it is a wonderful character, which is Antonio Aposa Jr., or Attorney Aposa, as he's known throughout the Philippines. And basically, Tony Aposa went walking in the mountains and in the forest, which was one of his great pleasures, and found the forest was gone. And it turned out it had been clear-cut. And when he looked a little further, he discovered that of the original old-growth forest in the Philippines, over 90% had been clear-cut. And permits had been issued by the Philippine government for an area that was something like 8 times as large as the amount of old-growth forest that was still standing. So way more than they actually even had. And he sued the Secretary of the Interior, whose name was Fulgencio Factorin, on the grounds that future generations were entitled to receive some of their ecological inheritance intact, and that he simply could not go on issuing clear-cutting permits for the rest of the old-growth forest. And a number of interesting things came out of that. One of them was that he was told in the lower courts that he couldn't bring this suit because you can't sue on behalf of future generations. Those are people who don't yet exist, and you can't sue on behalf of non-existent generations or non-existent people. That one got overturned in the Supreme Court, where the Philippines said, but look at the provisions in the Constitution. If there is any meaning to the idea of handing down a healthy environment to the future, then it means that, of course, you've got to consider the interests of people who don't yet exist. That's precisely what it does mean. So that was an interesting one. And then secondarily, Tony takes the view that he's a storyteller, not a lawyer, that his objective is not to win. His objective is to get the story told, and to get it told in such a way that there's a record, that evidence is heard and evidence is debated, and in the end you come to some kind of a resolution, and there is some decision taken for action. So as far as he's concerned, this is simply the best way of telling the story. And if he loses at the lower court level, he laughs, literally he laughs, and he goes on and takes it to the Court of Appeal, and then he gets to tell the story again and to bring the evidence in front of a large forum and so on and so forth. The particular point that you mentioned is one that delights me too, and that is that when he sued Factoran, Factoran basically pulled him aside and said, Tony, by all means proceed with this and let me see what I can do to help you. And let me see what evidence I can adduce that you can use in the case against me and the government. Because it turned out that Factoran knew perfectly well what was going on. He was a dedicated public servant. He didn't think that these permits should continue to be issued. He was delighted to be enjoined not to do that anymore. And as Tony says, my suit put wind under his wings. And so he was finally able to do what he thought was right in the first place, what he'd always wanted to do, but what he'd been prevented from doing by government and corporate interests who had pressed him in the opposite direction. That turns out to be a principle that Tony's made great, great use of throughout the Philippines. For example, on the beaches, he sued for a declaration that hotels could not encroach on the beaches of the Philippines as they had been doing. And the people in charge of that were delighted. They had gone on their own motion and said to Marriott Hotels, you can't be encroaching on the beach. Marriott would have said, who are you? And would have sued them and brought pressure against them and, through the political process and so forth. But now they don't have to do that. Now they can go and say, Mr. Marriott, I'm terribly sorry. I recognize this as being very, not what you'd like to see. But I can't do anything about this. I have a court order that directing me to do this. And if I don't do it, I can be jailed for contempt of court. So I'm afraid I'm going to have to enforce this provision on you. And there's not much the Marriott the hotel can chain or others can do about that. So it's a lovely device because it really gives muscle to people who know that they need to do the right thing and know what it is, but haven't been able to do it because of pressures from other sides.
They used to have debates in law school about what is the law for? And there's the traditional point of view that, as I said, it's a shield. It is to protect you. Well, what if the way to protect you is to use the law as a sword, to proactively go after those things that could, would, or may do you harm in the future or are doing you harm now, but there's no legal mechanism to rectify that? And this whole idea of dealing with, again, in quotation marks, the environment, struck me as just fascinating, the way that these folks are using the law as citizens to effect progressive, proactive change that will benefit all of us.
And that's exactly why I did the book and we did the film. And you're quite right. They are, in many cases, it's hard to say whether it's a sword or a shield. I mean, in the Netherlands, for example, the basis of a lawsuit there was the Urgenda Foundation was saying basically that climate change is a real danger to citizens of the Netherlands, in particular the Netherlands, since it's below sea level and sea level is rising. But they basically went to the government and said, you know, you guys are sued the government saying you guys agreed at Cancun that you had to achieve 25% to 40% reduction in carbon emissions by 2020, but you're not doing it. And not doing it breaches your duty of care to your citizenship, which is probably the most fundamental obligation of any government. And so the proactive stance is actually still a protective one. I mean, they won the case. The government has conceded that it has to do 25% reduction. It didn't like it. It's appealing it, but nevertheless, it has conceded that point. And that is a protective, but it's a proactive protection, right? It's like putting up a dam, you know, when you see rising sea level, as opposed to waiting for it to flood and then doing things to help people cope with the consequence.
So the last thing that I'd like to talk to you a bit about, or get your thoughts on, I suppose, would be a better way of looking at it, would be natural law. Because when I was in law school, I did my major research paper on the Nuremberg trials. And it was very much, you know, researching, there's statute-made law.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Canadian system, in the British system, that can come through both statutes, but it can also come through case law. Mm-hmm. But it's man-made law. Let's call it man-made, or let's call it human-made law, I guess is a better way to put it now. But then there was this concept in terms of international law, for me, extending back to Hugo Grotius, of natural law, that there are natural rights, that there is a natural law that trumps and informs human-made law. And you talk about the two of them in your book. And I'd like you, if you could, for the listeners to, in a better way than I could, because it's been 25 years since I wrote that paper, to expand a bit on what natural law is and how you think it's applicable to the kind of stories that these lawyers are telling in the book, the kind of struggle for environmental justice that, frankly, we're really all engaged in, whether we know it or not.
I remember when I was doing ethics in university, and I had a wonderful professor who was a great admirer of Bertrand Russell and some of his colleagues. And so you would get into these highly ingenious arguments about, you know, well, what is the good? What is right? And you get into these very convoluted things where people would wind up, you know, saying, in a sense, they're not that far away either. I mean, saying things like the destruction of Northern Alberta in order to extract a brief period of time when we have additional fossil fuels to drive what we fondly call the economy, that this is a good thing. Well, you know, it has its upsides and its downsides, but you look at Northern Alberta, you look at those great big settling ponds, which are sooner or later going to burst and go down the Mackenzie River. And you say, this is a good thing. We know perfectly well when things are right and wrong. We may, you know, there may be all kinds of ingenious arguments about it, but we really know. And I think that takes you close to where Aboriginal law is. And to me, one of the really interesting things that came up in this book was the number of times that we came up against Aboriginal concepts of law and Aboriginal concepts of where you would get ethical guidance. And that derives from the natural world. And so you look at the way that a bird cares for its young or that a weasel cares for its young. And that tells you something about the way that animals care for their young. And therefore, presumably, something about the way that humans should care for their young. Different reading, I think, of natural law than what you had in mind. But I kept running up against this, and I kept on thinking that there's a certain sense in which it's not as mysterious as we like to think, and that it's perfectly obvious that if you are destroying life, if you are destroying species, if you are destroying habitat, and so forth, you are doing something wrong. And it doesn't have to have a statute to tell you that. If you have made a species go extinct, you have done something wrong. And I don't think there's any real debate about that, except in circles where people have completely lost touch with reality. So to me, that was one of the things that really emerged from this book, was the number of people that are now falling back on that and are saying, no. If you are shrinking biodiversity, if you're closing off options for people and other animals, you're doing something wrong. And it doesn't take a parliament to tell you that.
It's interesting you mention how animals care for their young. Now that I've become a photographer of squirrels, which my friends on Facebook will recognize because I'm always posting pictures of squirrels, I sort of, you know, I bought a camera. My parents bought me a camera a couple of years ago for Christmas, and it forced me to take long walks in the woods because I had to take photos of something. And I sort of, for the first time in many, many years, kind of got back to that Thoreau, Walden kind of feeling where I would just want to go lose myself in the woods, and watch animals and see, you know, how that world works. And it changed my perspective in many ways on the world, but it also changed my perspective on the future. Because when you watch how these animals interact, in some cases with their own young, it got me to thinking about what do politicians always talk about? And as I'm entering the world of politics, I've become familiar with it myself. They always talk about the kids. It's all about the children. It's our children. We have to do, and then X, fill in the blank, whatever it is they're going to do, for the sake of the children. And usually they don't mean it. But, you know, we need hydraulic fracking for the children or whatever. And if there's anything that you need for the children, it would be a sustainable future where the planet is not some Mad Maxian wasteland of dystopian post-apocalyptic gloom and doom. And yet that seems to be something that they never actually want to talk about. How do you see a path forward in terms of changing hearts and minds? There's an American phrase that has an unfortunate connotation in other respects, but the idea of honestly changing hearts and minds so that we can get people thinking less, perhaps, in the traditional Western industrialized-centric kind of way, and more in tune with some of the ways you're talking about in the book, which involve looking at other cultures, other peoples, other ways of doing things, and frankly, other species.
Oh, absolutely, other species. Absolutely. We are part of a web of life, and we are not paying attention to that. We're not paying attention to our responsibility and our role in the overall structure of life on Earth, and that is one of our greatest problems. I don't know how the word conservative got uncoupled from the words conserve and conservation, but conserve and conservation mean the preservation of that which is valuable. And that is at the heart of what we're talking about here. And it, I think conservatism in its original meaning had to do with looking at that which was valuable in human experience and in our political lives and our histories as people living together, and trying to find from that what was important for us to have in our bag of tricks going forward, and not to be too reckless in our dedication to innovation. To me, this is still one of the really critical considerations here, that we're terribly willing. I mean, in a way, the kind of orientation that I espouse is a very conservative one. I mean, I don't believe we should be, for example, releasing pesticides into the world at large without knowing what their impact is going to be. I think that's the kind of innovation that's reckless. And in that sense, I would be very conservative about doing that kind of thing. I don't know how those things kind of got disassociated from one another. But I don't know the answer to your question of how do we bring about the change in consciousness that we really need, except to say that we do it the way we're doing it right this minute, where we talk about the alternatives, we talk about the true cost of the things that we're doing that are reckless and foolish, and we try to present alternative ways of looking at things that will lead people in more positive directions. I think that's one of the things that will help. The other thing that I think I say this and then I kind of despair about it, but as we start to see the consequences of our actions, and we start to see what it's costing us to behave as we have been behaving, you would think we would learn. But then you say, okay, but if you don't think climate change is important, and you look at the spruce beetle in British Columbia that has now turned the forest of British Columbia from a carbon sink into a carbon emitter, or you don't see that the hurricanes that we've experienced in New York and New Orleans, if New Orleans doesn't make you think twice, if Hurricane Sandy doesn't make you think twice, what will make you think twice? People can say, well, I guess it's a natural fluctuation. I don't remember when I was a kid, and I'm now, you know, well into my 70s. I don't remember these kinds of really powerful hurricanes coming again and again and again and again in such short order. I think you need to pay attention to that. But because it's difficult to draw that connection one-on-one, people have a capability of ignoring it. I think those of us who, you know, or maybe spending a little more time looking at this, have a real obligation to tell the truth as we've seen it. You know, and I that's really all that you and I can do, is do our best to spread the word, which is precisely what we're doing at this moment.
There's no one party, there's no one person, there's no one answer. I think you're quite right. The one thing that we can do is have these conversations and try and raise awareness. Although, you know, as you said, I despair when I say that. Because if awareness hasn't been raised by now, when are folks going to be aware when you see these kinds of climate disasters that even I'm younger than you, but even when I was young, I don't remember things like this happening.
Yeah.
And when something happens to your own body, you go see a doctor, right?
Mm-hmm.
You get it diagnosed, you let the experts do it. And then when the doctor says, here's the treatment, in this case, you might die if you don't do this, 99 times out of 100, you're probably going to take their advice. And in the 100th time, you're going to die. And yet we don't seem to take the same approach when it comes to the environment, climate, and all of this other stuff. We've had the diagnosis repeatedly, 97-98% of climate scientists, heck, 97-98% of all scientists, frankly, would say that this is real and this is happening and we have to do something. There's the diagnosis. So then the question becomes, well, are you willing to undertake the treatment? And it seems like an awful lot of people, at least in Western society, are not willing to undertake the treatment.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right that we ought to know better, and we ought to be behaving in a way that's consonant with the best understandings of the people who studied it. And to me, one of the glorious things about the stories that are in this book is that people have been able to take the law and to use the law to force attention to be paid to these things. I mean, the Netherlands case is a spectacular example, but there are lots of others. And basically, they've been able to go back to the law and connect the law with justice, either climate justice or intergenerational justice or, you know, various other forms of justice, but connect the law with justice and come down against some of these other issues and beat them, basically on the grounds that, I mean, that's where the law is one of the great human inventions, when it really does align itself with justice and people are able to use that alignment to make real progress on matters that mattered a lot to all of us.
People say, you left the law, Paul. I say, I never left the law. I left the practice of law. But the law never left me. I still love the law. because I still see the law the way I saw it when I was, you know, a 22-year-old young idealistic law student. It's not a tool of social control, although it's become that in many cases. To me, it was always a tool for implementing justice. If the end was not to implement justice in whatever context you were looking for, between two people or between two nations or between all of us, then what was the point of the law? So that, to me, when I read your book, and I remember when I first heard about it, it was Tim Bousquet had mentioned that you had this book and you were looking for media interviews and stuff, you know, anyone that could help get it out there. And I thought, first of all, I'd like to talk to Silver Donald Cameron. We're Facebook friends, but we've never met or talked. And secondly, this sounds like the perfect excuse because it's a book about Kung Fu Panda lawyers, which is not, folks, what it's about at all. And when you sent it to me and I read it, I immediately thought, this is the kind of law that attracted me when I was young. The book is infused with idealism, but to me, it's practical idealism. It's taking those ideals and putting them into practice in a productive and progressive way that benefits all of us. And so when I asked the question, I guess this is my kind of way of wrapping up in my long-winded way. When I asked you the question, how can people go about changing minds, hearts and minds? One of the ways you can do it would be to read Warrior Lawyers, From Manila to Manhattan, Attorneys for the Earth. When I read some of these stories, I just went, yes! You know, it's like one of those things where you want to stand up and yes, the good guy won. These are stories of where the good guys and the good gals actually won, using the law to tell a story. And in this case, the most important story that I guess we can probably tell, which is trying to save the planet, right?
Right, right. It also addresses another big question, which I've spoken about in the TED Talk, but then that question is, what can one person do? I hope the book is an antidote to despair. I hope that people read it and look at it and say, well, man, if this one person could make that kind of an impact, what can I do? What can I learn from this person that will allow me to take action of this kind of my own? This book is part of a much larger project called thegreeninterview.com, where we've been doing interviews with leading environmentalists from all over the world for the past 5 or 6 years. Got about 100 of them up on the site now. An awful lot of them are of that character, where we've gone to interview people who are making a real difference, and where somebody has seen something and said, I can pursue this and it will make a difference. Man, that, to me, that's one of the most important things that any of us can do, is to spread those stories so that people start to think, oh, wow, one person really can make a difference, and that one person could be me.
Absolutely. It's like the old shampoo commercial, too. You tell two friends, and they tell two friends, and so on, and so on, and so on. It doesn't have to be a big thing. It doesn't have to happen all at once. It is, in the very best sense of the word, a movement. And I think this book is part of it. You're clearly part of it. And it certainly inspired me to try and do as much as I can, whether it's in politics or whether it's in filmmaking or wherever it is, we can all make a contribution to changing the conversation and to getting a dialogue started that's long overdue about the kinds of things that we need to do in order to uphold the duty of care that we all have as human beings to the planet around us. Thank you very much, Silver Donald Cameron, for agreeing to chat with me and for our conversation. I've really, really enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Paul. I've enjoyed it very much, too.
The sun is gone, the shadows grow, our pockets kill the view. The rain it leaves through open holes, the wolf that does not hear. Tangled up in green, the clouds that fall from emptier skies, silent and unseen. The hands of time through today, the grass beneath the feet turns to dust. How much longer can this go on? Thank you. is gone.